Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, a wrap-up of results from Tuesday's election, including the win by Provo Mayor John Curtis in the special election to replace Jason Chaffetz, the dismissal of the case against former UTA board member Terry Deal, and more. And joining me to discuss these stories, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Welcome back to you, Dan. Thanks
for being
here. Let's see. Government reporter Jennifer Dobner is here with us as well. Jennifer, good morning. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Government reporter Courtney Tanner. Good morning, Courtney, and welcome.
Good morning.
And Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke is with us once again as well. Robert, glad to have you back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Join us with your questions and comments. You can leave those at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us up. We are at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Elections were held on Tuesday. Not, as far as I understand, not all of the results are final yet, but we do have most of the details. Courtney Tanner, for starters, as I think was widely expected, John Curtis won in the special election to replace Jason Chaffetz, and he won by a pretty sizable margin, right?
That's right. It's a 30-point lead right now ahead of Kathy Allen. It's not expected to change much.
Okay. Elected Tuesday, Curtis is slated to be sworn in on Monday, just the this coming Monday. And that's kind of an unusually quick turnaround, although, of course, having a seat in Congress vacant is also an unusual thing. But there's a reason for the rush, and Courtney Tanner, potentially that has to do with a couple of key votes coming up.
So he'll be sworn in Monday, and the House leadership told him, you know, you're going to vote this same night. We're going to swear you in, and a couple minutes later, you're going to cast your first vote in this. And they really need votes right now. There's tax reform, health care on the table. They're just kind of looking to get as many people as they can. I mean, Chaffetz was out of the seat for 4 months now, so.
Right. Okay. And trying to push a specific agenda through. During the campaign, Curtis kind of walked a tightrope on the question of, I don't know if allegiance is the right word, but his regard, I guess, for President Donald Trump. And that seems like a kind of political maneuver appealing to all sorts of sides. And I don't know if that's a fair characterization of what Curtis was doing, but maybe that's a question for either Dan Harry or Robert Gerke here. Dan, Curtis didn't want to be pinned down as a Trump supporter or as an opponent. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't think he really ever was a Trump supporter. He didn't vote for Donald Trump. He said he wrote in the name of a good friend. We don't know who that is. But, you know, he also didn't want to become one of the never Trumps or no to Trump. He supports generally the mainstream Republican agenda. And so, yeah, he was walking a tightrope. I think probably if you talk to him in private conversations, he would not say good things about the president. But he tries to claim that you can ignore his Twitter bursts and his, as he calls them, distractions, I think. But he says he supports in Maine his agenda.
Robert Gerke, Curtis was the mayor of Provo. He didn't win in the GOP convention, but he, you know, his win is seen as a sort of win for moderate, for the moderate wing of the Republican Party, moderate for this district anyways. What does his win say about politics in the state of Utah?
Well, I think it's a pretty significant shift because he's the highest profile candidate to have sort of bypassed the convention. He did go to the convention. He finished, I think, eighth in the convention, but gathered the signatures, enough signatures to go on and get on the ballot and win in the primary because he didn't necessarily, he wasn't viewed as conservative enough for the convention, but obviously he, you know, sort of steered to the mainstream and did well in the primary, won by a large margin in the general, obviously. So I think that sends a signal to other candidates that you don't have to go to the convention to get the nomination. This count my vote change, the SB 54 change, right, has made a significant difference now because he's not, as I mentioned in my column on Wednesday, he's not beholden to the delegates now. He's not captive of the right wing of the party. He can sort of be his own man if he decides to do that. You know, that's sort of what remains to be seen, whether he's going to do that. And then looking ahead, we've got the Count My Vote initiative that they announced this week that they're changing. They're going to keep the convention and have a primary process. But the other thing they're looking to do, and if this goes through will make a huge difference, is they're trying to lower the signature thresholds to make it a lot easier for more candidates like John Curtis to go in and go to the primary route instead of the convention route.
So they are, I mean, the Count My Vote is this is, again, the group that had originally advocated for these elections reforms that led to SB 54, compromise.
The primary route to the ballot. The ability to gather signatures to get on the primary ballot.
Right,
yes.
And they had, so they see, I guess, I mean, I don't know if this is exactly putting it right, but they see the win conceivably by Curtis as an example of where that compromise law is working, and that's why they're dropping their attempt to try and
I think that's part of it. I think that it is they were sort of touting this as here is an example of how we envision this system working and working well, you know, in the sense that, you know, the candidate, whereas if you didn't have the signature route to the ballot, we'd have Chris Herod as a nominee there. They think John Curtis is a much better fit for that district, and obviously the voters agreed. The reason they changed it, I guess, is they were having some issues. People weren't keen on the idea of getting rid of conventions, even though a lot of people don't like them. Getting rid of them would have limited the options for candidates, and they had a hard time with the public. The public was having a hard time sort of having this taken away from them.
This played out in public hearings where, or not public hearings, but public meetings where Count My Vote was, you know, inviting comment on what they were doing.
Yeah, and in the end, I mean, if you're the Count My Vote people, it's like, what harm does having the convention continue do? Because as we saw in this third congressional district special election, it didn't matter that the convention darling, Chris Herod, was out there. It didn't really help him in the primary. People didn't care that he was the favorite of delegates. Voters at large, or Republican voters at large who voted in the primary, just picked who they thought was the best candidate, and it was not Chris Herod.
And if they are able to lower these signature thresholds, you're going to see a lot more candidates on the ballot, and the convention's going to stop mattering. It's basically going to be, in Minnesota, for example, they have a party convention, but those conventions, the winner of the convention gets the party's endorsement. And they still go on to the primary, and it's still, you know, but the convention endorsement doesn't really mean all that much, as Dan mentioned in the Herod instance.
What is that? I mean, having more candidates, I'm sorry, we'll get back to election results here in a moment,
yeah,
but having more candidates, you know, on the ballot, that means that it's less predictable, the outcome. Is that an accurate statement? I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's, anytime you have more candidates on it, there's different dynamics that can take place, you know, strategic voting, people splitting voting blocks because they have similar views, that sort of thing. It makes it a lot more lively.
Well, I think it also is going to mean a lot more primaries. For years, both parties have been deliberately trying not to have primaries. They see them as taking away the delegates' power, as being expensive. And, you
exposing
know,
exposing vulnerabilities of candidates.
Right, exactly. And that the candidates in their party are spending most of their time and energy for a long period of time, you know, fighting somebody within the party rather than the other party. So I think you're just going to see a lot more of these primaries, and you're going to see, as Robert said, a lot more candidates on the primaries.
How about from the, just to stick with this election law for a moment longer, from the Republican Party's standpoint in the state of Utah, are they, I mean, we've heard that they were going to at one point drop their opposition or the lawsuit that they had. In the end, they undid that because we're actually just waiting for a decision in that lawsuit.
Yeah, it was kind of a crazy week for the SB 54 challenge. The party chairman wanted to drop the lawsuit. The state central committee rebelled against that, forced him to keep it going. So we're going to see this through. And as I mentioned when I was on the show recently, I think it's a good thing because I think ultimately a lot of these same issues are being raised in the Count My Vote initiative, and I think we need answers on the legality of it. And I think they're going to come back and say, well, yeah, it's all fine, but you know, let's get the courts to rule on it since we've come this far.
Okay. And then just getting back to Curtis's pending, well, let's get back to the race between Curtis and his Democratic opponent. And Courtney, you reported that that the opponent from the Democratic side had her own thoughts about what this win says about politics in the state of Utah. This is Dr. Catherine Allen, and some comments that she made in Facebook after the election.
Yeah, she posted on social media and later took it down. You know, her campaign said it was just kind of a message of frustration, but she said pretty much that the only reason Curtis won is that he was Mormon and Republican and she was not. And she apologized, but it was kind of a...
Okay.
Yeah.
And just out of frustration expression. Do we know the kind of priorities that that Curtis is going to pursue in D.C.? You've written a little bit about this, about what he plans to do when he gets there.
So healthcare and tax reform is kind of his stock answer, which is every Republican's answer right now. He's kind of given his preference for a committee, which would be energy and commerce. We don't know if that's the assignment he'll get. It's a pretty exclusive committee just because it covers so much, but it would have kind of an impact with Utah, with Bears Ears and any development that might come if that gets shrunk down a little bit.
Gerke, Robert Gerke, the opinion columnist, the pressure to conform to the agenda of a party. I mean, this is part of party politics. You get to your seat in Washington, and I think you're expected to cast votes along party lines sometimes, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's especially for a freshman, there's tremendous pressure to conform. And a lot of times that pressure is brought about in, you know, the leverage they have are things like committee assignments, things like campaign funding, campaign support from the party. So, you know, there is intense pressure, especially, again, on a freshman, you know, to go along and get along. And it's going to be a real test for John Curtis. I think, he has sort of adopted this posture that he's the moderate in the sort of voice of reason, whatever. But it's really hard for that to sort of survive very long when you get into the pressures of Washington, D.C., because at the end of the day, he's one of 435 votes in the House. But, when they need those votes, they're going to come and come to him, and they're going to apply every ounce of pressure they can put on him to do it. So. Okay.
Well, a quick reminder to our listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255. You can comment at sltrib.com. We do need to head to a quick pause here. When we come back, we'll tackle some more election-related news. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
This is Science by the Slice. Hot springs are windows to fluid rock interactions deep within the earth, says USU geochemist Dennis Newell. Studying the spring's chemical composition yields clues about the thermal water's origins, he says. The water may be young, having recently fallen as precipitation from the sky, or it could have been stored in underground aquifers for tens of thousands of years. Chemical analysis reveals the water's fingerprint, a history of where it came from and where it's been.
This segment of Science by the Slice is brought to you by the USU College of Science, offering degree programs in mathematics and varied scientific disciplines. Details at usu.edu/science.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune, their government editor, Dan Harry, reporters Courtney Tanner and Jennifer Dobner, and columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday news wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us up. We are at 801-355-TALK. All right, let's continue with some election stories here, and there are kind of too many to go through one by one, but maybe we'll jump into a bit of history being made, Dan. This is Provo getting its first female mayor. Michelle Calfusi will most likely take over for the congressman-elect we were just talking about, John Curtis.
Right, and it's been Provo's been a city for 157 years, and they have never had a female mayor before. Wow. So, yeah, that'll be refreshing.
150 years, a long time coming, but that we knew that a woman one way or another was going to win this election because her most competitive opponent was a woman as well.
Right. Sherry Hall Everett was the other general election candidate. So, yeah, we were assured of that. Yeah.
Mm. I'm guessing that the swearing in of this candidate, I mean, of Michelle Calfusi will happen pretty soon because John Curtis is going off to Provo. Is that right? No.
Well, you would think so, but the canvass really isn't until, I think, the 21st. And so In most cases, and that's what's kind of surprising about the swearing in of Curtis, is most cases they have to wait until the election results are certified, that they're really official. And that is 2 weeks after the election. Actually, in the case of this congressional election, it's 3 weeks. So those results won't be certified till then. But both candidates, Allen and Curtis, during the election said, they think it was fine that the swearing in took place early and quickly, especially if the results were convincing, and they were.
Right. So. Yeah, Congress kind of gets to make its own rules about who it seats and who it doesn't, so they can seat him without the canvass being finished. With the Provo City Mayor example, they've kind of got to wait until that canvass is done under state law.
Okay. Just quickly, she was the former head of the school board. And I'm wondering if there are any kind of radical new plans for the city of Provo here from Michelle Calfusi. What did she run?
You know, we haven't heard really any kind of strong agenda from her except economic development. She's kind of suggested that she would continue the policies of John Curtis. You know, I think that John Curtis has been pretty popular in Provo as the mayor. They've had a lot of growth during this period. And that looks like it's going to continue even at an accelerated pace in the future. Utah County is smaller than Salt Lake County, but it's growing much faster, and Provo's right in the middle of that. So,
The name Calfusi will probably ring a bell for some listeners, football-aware listeners, that is, because she comes from a family that's almost a dynasty.
Yeah, and it couldn't hurt. You know, names matter in elections. So,
Okay. Well, that's the mayor of Provo. Here in Salt Lake County, there were some interesting results for mayor as well. Lee Davidson reported that four incumbent mayors appeared to be losing their seats, among them Sandy Mayor Tom Dolan, and that's after 24 years.
That's probably the most surprising one. The fellow that was facing Tom Dolan, sort of the fixture in Sandy for that long, since, 1994, I believe it was. Kurt Bradford, I believe is his name, Brad Byrne. He's a state attorney. He's never really run a campaign before. He went after Dolan. He took the gloves off. He talked about, you know, his close association with lobbyists, with developers, with big business, kind of suggested that he didn't, I don't think, use the word corruption, but he was suggesting that the city government there was corrupt. And I guess I would say that there was probably Dolan fatigue after that long in Sandy.
Well, incumbents lost also in Taylorsville, Riverton, and West Jordan. And maybe this is a question for Robert Gerke, but we talk about the advantage for incumbents. Is that maybe less true at the mayoral level? I mean, does it go away after? I mean, Dan's talking about fatigue.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Dan. I think that maybe there's sort of an anti-incumbency sentiment that we saw this election, because we saw Bill Applegarth in Riverton, Tom Dolan, you mentioned, there were
Larry Johnson, and Kim Rolfe in West Jordan.
Yeah, and these people had served for a long time in places that aren't known for sort of these big rebellions. I think that maybe there's just a sense that people are tired of the status quo and wanted to change it up a little bit. In South Salt Lake, Sheree Wood won narrowly over a challenger. And so you have other races. The Draper mayor race was fairly close. Troy Walker holding on to beat Michelle Weeks. So, yeah, I mean, I think maybe there is. I mean, we'll have to see how it goes. It may be too early to read too much into this. But leading into the 2018 elections, it's going to be something to watch.
Okay. We're kind of burning through a lot of stories here, but Dan, let's move on to some of the Salt Lake City Council races if we can, and maybe we can start with the race to replace outgoing Councilman Stan Penfold in the district that covers the Avenues, Marmalade, right, Capitol Hill, Federal Heights. This is District 3, and the competition here was between Chris Wharton and Phil Carroll. What happened there?
Yeah, so Chris is the winner, apparently, from the unofficial results. Phil Carroll, he ran a strong campaign, and he finished a strong second. But unless those votes that are still out there to be counted change the numbers dramatically, it looks like Chris Wharton will be the next council member.
Sure. And just this is a very liberal part of the city. Chris Wharton kind of fits that. He's done a lot of pro bono work for the LGBT community, and so I think that sort of created a momentum for him to slide in there.
Okay, that was the distinction. What was his opponent running on? Do we know the kind of campaign? Sorry, I know it's specific to a very small city council election, but
he said that affordable housing was his number one issue, and he's been involved in affordable housing for many years. But, you know, Chris Wharton was claiming the same issues. So in terms of issues, they really didn't distinguish themselves about what they were saying their priorities would be.
Okay. And then in the District 7 race to replace Lisa Adams on the council, Amy Fowler, a public defender, appears to be the winner there. This is in Sugar House.
Sugar House area. Yeah, Amy worked that race really hard, and she's run for office before, but this is the first time she's pulled it off. I think there was one of the big issues there was obviously the siting and then removal of that homeless shelter, and then also just sort of some of the growth issues they've got to deal with. She was running against somebody who was
Abe Smith,
who was an IT specialist, I guess, for the LDS Church. So he had sort of the more traditional Mormon profile, I think. But
Which doesn't always help
in that more liberal part of the town. So. So it's some new faces on the council.
Well, new faces. I mean, actually, a lot of the I can't remember the exact number, but there's a lot of young faces on the council. I mean, some number of them are millennials, and that's is that
kids these days,
exactly.
Yeah, right. Because you've got Chris Wharton and Amy both young people joining. You know, Derek Kitchen and Charlie Luke is not an old man, but I guess now
Andrew
he's the
Johnson,
old man on it. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's a young council. It's an ambitious council. I think there's already noise about several of these people having their eye on running against Jackie Biskupski in 2 years.
Are those rumors, or is there more information about that? Just out of curiosity.
Well, I mean, you've probably heard the same name we have, that Stan Penfold wants to run and that Derek Kitchen is interested in running. And
there's also been talk, I think, about Lisa Adams.
Yeah, Lisa Adams, Aaron Mendenhall. Basically, everybody who's ever served on the council wants to be mayor.
All right. Speaking of council races, still we have a couple to go through in the Liberty Park area. This is a Central Salt Lake incumbent, Aaron Mendenhall. Coasted to a second term. She was up against a community activist. This is George Chapman.
Yeah. And George runs, I think, every election, doesn't he?
He runs as often as I do. So, yeah, he's pretty active. And he's active in people know George, I think, because he's active in city council meetings, legislative meetings, things like that. I don't know if he used the term gadfly, but yeah, he seems to be.
Yeah, and I will say that George attends a lot more government meetings than Gerke does.
That's true.
He's city council, county council, UTA. It seems like wherever there's a public meeting, there's George Chapman.
But he's
a retired gentleman. He's very intelligent. He's very active, and I don't think he has a hobby. Pickleball is a good one if he ever gets tired of government. So.
Dan Harry, pickleball enthusiast. But Aaron Mendenhall, she won by a wide margin here, right? I mean, she just – is that, again, an incumbent's advantage in the election, or is it because she didn't – I mean
– I think it's incumbent advantage, but also I think the challenger, you know, the candidates matter, and I don't know that the challenger necessarily was able to, you know, to go toe-to-toe with her.
Okay. And then finally, in District 1, which includes Rose Park, this is the northwest quadrant of Salt Lake City, incumbent James Rogers won.
His opponent dropped out, withdrew from the race. So he got 100% of those ballots that were counted. So.
All right. Politics here in Salt Lake City is nothing like politics in the rest of the state. But did Robert Gerke, did any of these results from city council races surprise you?
Not so much. I mean, the fact that those incumbents won, I thought, was pretty much a foregone conclusion in both the Wharton race and the Fowler race. The winner from the primary ended up winning the general. The themes were not, there weren't big themes, I don't think, in the outcome. I think, they're new faces, but I think by and large, a lot of the same messages.
Okay. One of the interesting things, and Courtney discovered this the other day when she was looking at the county-by-county returns in the 3rd congressional district, and that is that Kathy Allen did win in one county, unlike past where we'd expect that to be Salt Lake, it was Grand County. And she narrowly lost in San Juan County, which, we generally think of as a very conservative place. But there's a huge Navajo population there that generally votes Democratic.
Hmm. Is any of that, could any of the potential turnout there be backlash for public lands policies or, the controversy over Bears Ears National Monument, for example?
I think John Curtis had a more sort of traditional Republican, message on the monuments than Kathy did. And I think Kathy Allen was a proponent of keeping the monuments in place. which in when you go into San Juan County and have that and make that argument, it's a little bit harder to pull off. So I think that's an interesting result, just because there's this perception that San Juan County is adamantly against the monuments, and if she can go down there with a pro monument and a Democratic message, then and do fairly well, maybe that's a sign that San Juan isn't quite as conservative as we've been led to believe.
Yeah, and then the last thing that was interesting there, I thought, was in Salt Lake County, John Curtis did prevail. It was narrowly, but he did win the Salt Lake County portion of the congressional district.
That's interesting. I mean, I was talking about Salt Lake County being an island inside of the state of Utah, but Grand County actually went for Kathy Allen. Do we know why there? Same reason.
Moab.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the growth of Moab. Grand County has been one of those counties Democrats can usually do okay in. And frankly, did Hillary win Grand County? I think Hillary did win Grand County. So for that to go to a Democrat is not that out of the ordinary. Carbon used to be one they could count on. It's kind of gone the other way. So and San Juan used to be one that they could win in. So maybe we're seeing those sort of shift back a little bit.
Just for a quick moment, because we were talking about the Bears Ears National Monument, we have an impending visit by President Donald Trump in the next
first part of December, they say.
Do we have further details about where he's going to be and what the details of what the meat of the announcement is going to be on these national monuments?
Not really. There was a story out of the San Juan paper, I believe, that said he was going to be in San Juan County to make the announcement, which the logistics of that are a little mind-boggling. You don't exactly land Air Force One anywhere in San Juan County. So we're going to have to see how this goes. We are still expecting him to shrink both monuments, yes, or attempt to shrink both monuments. And so, but we don't know exactly how much. The state, as we've reported, as asking for about 150,000 acres for the Bears Ears, which is about a 90% reduction. What we're hearing about Grand Staircase is that they might break it into several pieces, the idea being maybe free up some of the coal deposits in there. And we actually just won a grandma case yesterday against Kane County to try to get a copy of their recommendations to the Interior Department for what they'd like that monument to look like after Trump's executive order, so we'll see those when we get them.
Unfortunately, that'll probably be after the announcement,
since they have an
appeal period.
Yeah.
Just quickly on process, he'll show up, he'll make an announcement, I'm changing the size of these monuments, and then court cases will ensue.
The theory is right now that he'll try to rescind both monuments and then issue a new order to reinstate portions of the monument, and that way you can actually start making some changes on the ground through the actual order, through the executive order. And then, they're both the Navajo, or not the Navajo, but the Dine Vaquea, the Indian groups, and the environmental groups have said that they are prepared to sue. And it's two interesting issues, because shrinking a monument that has been in place for 20-plus years in the Grand Staircase is a different proposition than shrinking a monument that was just created last year. And so they might end up litigating those two different separately. So it's going to take several years of court cases to try to come to resolution on this.
My greatest hope is that we will see the president and capture his image on horseback.
Oh, so. Dan Harry's greatest hope. I love it. Just certainly,
wind whipping through his hair.
Circling back to elections results for just a moment here, I don't know, there are other elections that occurred all around the state and in various counties. Bond issues, for example, I know there were some school board bond issues, and I'm wondering if the passage of those, we saw four of six efforts to raise money for schools passing, if that might bode well for a group like our schools now.
It would seem so. It shows at least that a lot of folks are willing to increase their taxes for public education. I think what you will see, though, in the statewide effort is there will be a very organized, coordinated campaign against as well as for the initiative. And so that may be that's on a different scale.
Yeah, people are going to be a lot more aware of the Our Schools Now initiative than they were on the bond initiative, where they probably just showed up and
turnout's low in a municipal election generally. This was maybe a little higher because of the congressional race, but still pretty low turnout compared to a general election.
Do we know how the, I mean, speaking of these initiatives, how the signature gathering efforts of the groups that are doing initiatives for next year, we're talking about Our Schools Now,
Marijuana, medical marijuana,
also
the redistricting.
Yes, correct.
And also Medicaid expansion is out there. Count My Vote people are going to start all over. They're going to start collecting signatures because they just changed what their initiative is going to be. But the reports that I've seen indicate that the others are doing quite well, and they're popular. You know, they're polling well as well.
Turkey?
Yeah, I think I've heard mostly the same thing. I think I don't think the Medicaid one has started gathering signatures, and I'm not sure where the redistricting is, but I've heard that people are enthusiastic about the medical marijuana initiative and the Our Schools Now initiative. I think they're hiring professional signature gatherers, so that should make it a little bit easier for them.
Well, the Medicaid ballot initiative passed in Maine as well this week, so
yeah.
I don't know if that...
I think it's an interesting signal. I think it bodes well. And I think, if I remember right, our poll had something like 60% of people supported the ballot initiative to expand Medicaid. So was that right? You don't remember the numbers.
I don't remember.
It was a majority, though, if I remember right. Yeah. So that's got to be encouraging for them. And, I think we've always seen good numbers for the Medicaid expansion, whether it was Governor Herbert's Healthy Utah or a straight expansion. I kind of expected those numbers maybe to soften a little bit with the Trump people, with the Trump actions trying to undercut Obamacare. So, but as Dan mentioned, there's going to be, these are all going to be sort of vigorous campaigns on both sides. What I'm kind of interested in is to see where the money is going to come from to oppose these, because traditionally, you would have the same groups opposing several of these, and that's going to strain their resources, I think.
Okay. Are we missing – what are the – I mean, we're missing so many election stories here. Any big ones that you want to comment on before we move on to other stories, Dan, Harry?
Well, maybe I'll just air a personal beef, and that's about Utah County. Once again, I don't understand what's going on down there on elections when they can't seem to get the votes counted. It's just mind-boggling. And you know, we were watching all night long. You go to their website, and it says the results will be reported shortly after 8 p.m., and it was at least an hour and probably more than after 8 p.m. when they posted those results. I don't understand it.
Democracy's hard, Dan. Come on.
Nobody knew it would be this complicated.
I think we need to kind of note what happened at the national level, too. I mean, I think the landslide that the Democrats enjoyed in Virginia and the victory of Democratic governors in New Jersey and in Virginia, taking back the Senate in Washington, some really interesting stories out of Virginia about the transgender candidate who beat the guy who sponsored the bathroom bill.
Right.
I mean, it was a Tuesday, even though it's a midterm election, you don't want to read too much into it, but it was a good night for Democrats. And I think it could show, and I don't want to extrapolate too much, so there's a caveat, but it could show that there's an anti-Trump sentiment that's building and that it has effects down ticket on state legislative races and so forth. And so that's something we're going to have to watch as we head into 2018, because we had several state legislative races, I believe five state legislative races, that were all within a very small margin of error last year. And if there's anything weighing those candidates down, those Republican candidates down, it could make a difference.
Well, it also, I think, emphasized continuing, fractures within the Republican Party. You saw the president kind of trash Ed Gillespie, who was the mainstream Republican candidate. And
Jeff Flake has said that he's going to retire, citing
differences
with the president.
And Bob Corker's going after the president. I think one of the ones that we have to watch now is the Alabama Senate race. That's next month. The allegations that have arisen about Roy Moore sort of having relationships with teenage girls it could be damaging to him. And that's a seat that's a race. The candidate who's running against him there is a solid candidate. I mean, the idea that Alabama, which is like, as red as Utah, would even be competitive is sort of hard to fathom. But I think it could be now.
Well, late in the race, there's not much you can do about it. Go ahead, Dan.
Right. They can't replace. They say it's too late to replace him as a candidate on the Republican ticket.
But next year, I mean, will the races that we see run in Congress be referendums on Trump's presidency?
I think typically the first term midterm elections for any president don't go very well. I think Democrats will try to make it a referendum on his presidency. I think they still need to get good candidates out. The Republicans, they're going to have some calculus to do, because a candidate like Mia Love has to decide how much she's going to associate herself with the Trump presidency, because she's staring down the barrel of a pretty good challenger in Ben McAdams, and I guess Darlene McDonald is in the race as well. So, you know, she's voted with Trump 96% of the time, and she's going to have to going forward, she's going to have to decide how much she wants to, as Trump said, embrace his message, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing in this district.
I'm sorry to get stuck in the national weeds here for one more second, but there's talk of Steve Bannon, you know, who was Trump's sort of major, he was his...
His political strategist.
Talking about funding campaigns of people who are loyal to Trump, but going against, you know, going after people who are not loyal to Trump. Is that going to have an effect on Utah, for example?
Well, I think, you know, Dan talked a little bit earlier about circular firing squads, and I think that dynamic could... If what it turns into is sort of long, bloody Republican primaries where you have a wounded candidate emerging on the other end, it could actually work against them. And when he's talking about going after established Republicans, like he was talking about going after Jeff Flake, or he's talking about going after some of these guys, Orrin Hatch even, that creates a huge internal divide, and I don't think it would be beneficial for the candidates for either side if they're trying to hold on. But, you know, the math still looks pretty good for Republicans to control the Senate. We'll see what it looks like as we get closer about the House.
I just think that if Steve Bannon knocks on your door and says, hey, will you run against Orrin Hatch? I'll give you a bunch of money. A lot of people are going to be tempted to do that.
I think there's a good chance that he is able to find somebody to do it. And that all presumes that Orrin runs. And I think, you know, if Mitt Romney runs, I guess he said he would still run a candidate against Mitt Romney if he steps in to replace Orrin Hatch. So we could see a big Republican primary fight next year.
Okay, guys, we need to head to another break here. Again, there's a lot of races from around the county and state from Tuesday's elections that we didn't get to, and you can find full results at sltrib.com or the Lieutenant Governor's election website, for that matter. When we come back, we'll turn to the dismissal of the case against former UTA board member and developer Terry Deal. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a moment.
When you think of an engineer, what comes to mind? Do you think of creative problem solvers who design life-saving tools and modern technologies that each of us use every day? Or do you think of Dilbert, the famous comic strip engineer with his signature striped tie and pocket protector? It turns out, our perception of who engineers are and what they do is a little skewed. And now, engineers are trying to change that. Across the country, engineers and engineering educators are changing the conversation about engineering. They're recruiting more women and a more diverse workforce, and showing students that engineers are innovative people making a positive difference in our lives every day.
Support on Utah Public Radio for Creating Tomorrow is provided in part by our members and the College of Engineering at Utah State University, offering an engineering education PhD to empower tomorrow's engineering education leaders. Learn more at engineering.usu.edu.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Jennifer Dobner, Courtney Tanner, and Robert Gerke. You can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 355-8255. You can also comment on the KCPW Facebook page or at sltrib.com. I'm going to turn to government reporter Jennifer Dobner now. And Jennifer, we kicked off... the week, that is, kicked off with a kind of surprise turn, at least a surprise to me anyways, in the court case against a former UTA board member and developer. This is Terry Deal. The surprise here was that the case was dismissed before it even kicked off. That dismissal was sort of the culmination of a long, sputtering case against Deal. Tell us about this. Why was the case not heard, Jennifer?
Well, you're right. It was a long, sputtering case. You know, it was filed originally back in April with 12 counts. Then around the 1st of October, everything started to shift. The government added a couple of tax charges, and then there were a series of court hearings, after which each time they started to dump counts. First time 11, and then two more, and leaving them with only one.
Can we, before we get to this this most recent term, why were those other, you know, the 14 charges, why were they dropped one by one by one?
Well, so always before you get to the trial, lawyers start arguing about what evidence they can introduce and what evidence they can't and where they're going with their case. And the U.S. District Judge Clark Waddups had made some rulings that limited in some ways the scope of the evidence that prosecutors could introduce. And so each time they made some changes to the indictment, they said it was because the judge's ruling had, you know, foreclosed opportunities for them to, provide things to a jury. Mm-hmm. And that sort of came to a head the Friday before the trial was supposed to start.
Which is a week ago today.
Yeah. And it was late in the afternoon. And so there was some last minute jostling back and forth about witnesses that were going to be called. Which happened, I think, probably more frequently than normal as you move towards a trial, because this case had changed, you know, basically four times in 30 days, which is pretty unusual. Mm-hmm. And so after the last round, Diehl's attorneys objected to some of the witnesses that the government would plan to present. And Waddups' response to that was basically to direct both sides that this particular avenue of talking about this case related to some specific evidence could not be introduced to the jury in opening statements. Mm. And the government felt that had pretty much gutted three-quarters of their case. And what this is about is one document that was filed in Mr. Diehl's bankruptcy.
Right.
It was a financial statement from April 13th, 2012. And that document failed to disclose a company called Skyline Ventures Associates, which is a company that was set up by Diehl and his daughters with them as the principals, but a company that he actually controlled. Its day-to-day operations and its bank accounts. So the government's theory was that he set this company up specifically to defraud creditors, and that he controlled the money that went in and out of there, and therefore he controlled how much money was available to repay his debts, which in his bankruptcy case, that was like a $41 million debt.
So was this about concealing assets then, or was it?
Originally the charges were making false statements and concealing assets. In particular, a $1 million payday that Diehl got from the sale of some land down by the Draper Front Runner Station, which is tied into that whole UTA right. scandal from some years ago about those land transactions.
But those charges, I mean, charges related to those land, this is the original part, those charges disappeared quite a while ago.
They did. So what was left was the one document and how much you could argue about that document. The government, as Mr. Diehl's attorney said many times, wanted to do, try a broad case, use all the acts before and after the filing of that one document as the argument to show that he was deliberately defrauding people and still basically living the lavish lifestyle that he's known for. The court was not so inclined to let them do that. They wanted the government to stay very focused on a more narrow set of facts. And I think the government's case was likely pretty thin. And the judge called them out for that and said, if you're telling me you can't try this case with what you have left, then maybe you should not have ever brought this indictment at all.
Hmm. So just essentially not having enough evidence to secure a conviction, but also from the judge's standpoint, when the judge gives you a tip-off like that your case might not be holding water,
yeah,
it's worth dropping.
Well, and the courts don't allow you to basically put uncharged conduct on trial. Hmm. And so all those counts that they had intended to bring were gone, and they couldn't really ethically use that, any of that, against a defendant, and that's what Waddup said.
Again, the thing that sort of kicked this story off a number of years ago, as you said, was that when Diehl was a UTA board member,
mm-hmm.
he and his partner, his business partner, got a loan. Was it a $10 million
loan? $10 million loan at the end of 2009 so that they could purchase so that they that they used to purchase property in Draper around about 128 South, around where the UTA built their Front Runner station. That land was later sold for many millions more, and that has been the subject of two really critical audits of UTA and allegations of, you know, using insider information and ethical missteps on the part of Mr. Deal. Now, allegedly, the federal government has an ongoing investigation.
This is the FBI.
Yeah, the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office are still investigating that. But that sort of is the million-dollar question now, right? Is something really going to come of that? Those things happened a long time ago. There are statute of limitations issues. Mm. We don't really know what the scope of that investigation is.
But if you're Terry Deal, you might not know whether or not you're kind of out of the woods here, if that's a pending investigation.
I think that's probably true to some extent, although certainly his attorneys are probably talking to government attorneys about what information he has. I suspect that there are, from some of the investigative documents that we have obtained over the last year, it's clear that they have been talking to a lot of people involved with those land transactions. I believe from the list of potential witnesses in this case that just was dismissed was Deal's former office manager and accountant, who was in control of the, who carried out his right. his orders about where to move the money, and also that previous business partner, Jeff Vitek, who was in on the UTA deal. He was a key witness for the government in the this bankruptcy fraud case, and he had, from things we knew from court statements, had provided them with pages and pages and pages, thousands of pages of documents. So,
just quickly, when you talk about the government and the lawyers prosecuting this case, are they at all in communication with the FBI on their own investigation, or are they two separate things entirely?
There was a room full of guys in suits on Monday in the courthouse. So many of them were FBI agents. I recognize some, I was told, were from the Department of Justice outside of Utah. So I think there's a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes. We just don't know where it's going yet.
UTA, meanwhile, says that it has been undergoing this process of reform, and this was because of the scrutiny that it was getting of things like this loan to Deal and his business partner. So they've been doing this for a number of years now, a kind of reform process. Can you talk about that?
I can, and probably Dan's edited more of those stories, so he might have something to say. But yeah, I mean, they make a very quick point always that they've had, you know, almost a wholesale change of everybody who was involved in UTA at that time. And that they are instituting reforms and checks and balances to make sure those kinds of things have don't happen again.
Dan Harry,
however,
yeah, any comment on that? On what on the process of reform at UTA?
Yeah, they're still making some changes. Just recently, we've been fighting for actually several months to get the conflict of interest disclosures of board members, and it was a long, kind of wearying process, but they've now announced that they're recommending a new policy that those will become public in the future. The problem was they have these supposedly detailed conflict of interest forms, and they assured the board members that they would be private, and I don't think they should have done that. But in the future, those will be public.
Guys, we are really low on time here, and I would love to get Robert Gerke's comment on this, because, Robert, this isn't the only case against a Utah power broker that has faltered in recent years.
True.
The Tribune ran through a litany of these cases in a piece published this last week, cases against former attorneys General John Swallow, Mark Shurtleff, businessman Jeremy Johnson, real estate guru Rick Korber is a recent one, Mark Sessions Jensen, and so on and so on. What's the common denominator here, Robert Gerke?
I think corruption pays. right now, there's just no way for white-collar prosecutors to get convictions of these guys, and it sends, I think, an unsettling signal in a state like ours that already has a reputation for white-collar crime that the laws can't touch you.
Jennifer, last thing, what will Deal do now in like 30 seconds, because we've got to move to our underclad stories?
I've been told he plans to, you know, keep doing what he's doing and go out and reclaim his good name.
Okay. A lot of legal effort and ink spilled, and we'll see if anything more comes of it from the FBI investigation. Underplayed stories of the week. Let's turn to that now. Quickly, Jennifer Dobner, do you have a pick?
it's, I don't know if that it's underplay, but it's the story today about the new observatory in Torrey, Utah. I'm totally geeked out on science because of it, and it's just kind of cool.
One of the few places where you can still see the Milky Way in Utah.
Yeah, really cool.
Dan Harry underplayed the story.
I don't know if it was underplayed, but the story about inmate torture in the Daggett County Jail that's now been shuttered, the Tribune partnered with the Utah Investigative Journalism Project to publish that story and interview for the first time these inmates who had been victims. If you haven't read it, it's still online, and it's a chilling, chilling story.
Okay, we'll check it out at sltrip.com. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story.
A giant new liquor store in West Wendover. Lee's Discount Liquor opened last
for
month.
For Nevadans, right?
For Nevadans. Yeah, just for Nevadans. It's
right.
Great news for Nevadans. And,
we should say that it is illegal to go across the border, buy alcohol,
it's
and bring it back.
It's a misdemeanor.
And I would never encourage anybody to do that. Okay. And I'll see
it
you next weekend.
Okay, understood.
Like fireworks.
Courtney Tanner, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I think this just kind of got buried with all the election news, but Brian Maffley had this interesting piece on Zion National Park and how it has to deal with a human waste problem because there are so many people visiting.
An overflow of visitors, etc., at Zion National Park. Well, for my part, I'm going to go with, I was going to go with this absurd story, Salt Lake City's first cat cafe, which opened last weekend on 9th South and 3rd East. So there's that, but I think
that's
I'll mention...
It's not absurd.
It's not absurd. I'm going to mention something that we didn't have time to get to today. The Paradise Papers, a trove of leaked documents related to offshore holdings. There are some local ties. But one of the gists of these documents is that offshoring of a lot of money through legal means is something that is propping up inequality around the globe. And so you can check that out. Easy Google search to find. Dan Harry, Jennifer Dobner, Courtney Tanner, Robert Gerke, all from the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you to KCPW's Jesse Ellis, who is the technical wizard behind everything here at KCPW. In Logan, Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen manage the broadcast. And thanks are always due to producer Emily Means. You can find podcasts of this show and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. We are on Facebook and Twitter as well. You can find us and follow us there. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here again next week.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and USU Student Media, proud to celebrate 115 years since the first Student Life newspaper was published in November 1902. More information on the celebration available at studentmedia.usu.edu.
I'm John Kovash, Utah Public Radio correspondent for Moab in Southeast Utah. If you have comments, questions, or ideas for stories for any of us at the station, please visit our website at upr.org or call 1-800-826-1495. You can also share your ideas with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Be sure to include the hashtag IMUPR. Thanks for listening.
Service of Utah State University's College of Humanities and Social Sciences. This is KUSR Logan, KUSU-FM Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, Moab, KUST Price, KCEU, and streaming online at upr.org.